This is Ivor Morgan, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 26th of October, 2012.
My name is Ivor, I-V-O-R, that's the English way, P, Morgan. The P stands for Prothero, which is another Welsh, it's a family name.
Where were you born?
I was born actually in London, England. Ah, well, you laugh at that, but I've also lived in London, Ontario, Canada, right?
Okay.
And I was born on the 3rd of August, 1937.
So you are now how old?
I'm 75 years old.
Okay, all right. And you're very Welsh, despite the accent and
overseas. I was born into a very Welsh family, and I grew up in a Welsh community in London. I went to a Welsh chapel, which is a Welsh-speaking chapel. There used to be a network of these. London is was the domain for a lot of the Welsh families from Cardiganshire, as it was then, now called Ceredigion, who set up in the various milk businesses around London. It was a network of Welsh families, and I'm descended from these Welsh families. During the war, I spent a part of that war in Wales, in the middle of the Welsh countryside. I went to a village school. I learned to read and write in the village school. And every summer and every spring, I spent in Cardiganshire working at my relative's farm until I was in my late teens, I think, probably.
Had you intended to be a surveyor?
I had never, ever thought about being a surveyor. I was trained as a scientist, a geologist type, and while I was doing my undergraduate, I was thinking about becoming a foundations engineer. So I started doing some civil engineering, things like structures, then when I had finished my undergraduate degree, so basically I was sort of a scientist, mostly pure science, physics and stuff. And so geophysics with a bit of engineering. I looked around for work and I was looking for, I think, a challenge. And I had a lot of big companies, surprised to me, they were actually interested in me. I think it might have been my RAF background because I had been an officer and I had had a position of some responsibility in those years. Rather bizarre situation that only the military could do.
How do you mean?
Well, I think I had never expected to be commanding officer of a small radar station at the age of 20, for instance. That wasn't on my
radar.
Right. the station, I actually closed that one. It was the monitor station of the Southwestern G chain. If you really want to know what G is, you have to look up some books. I was also station adjutant of Royal Air Force North Weald, which is a famous Battle of Britain station. That also closed after my time. And that's another accident of, so I think those things actually probably made me interesting to some of these other firms. So I remember British American Tobacco wanted to employ me, and there was a very small ink firm. And I remember the question this guy asked me. He said, "I want you to ask yourself this question." He said, "Can you devote your life to ink?" And I said, "Well, since you ask it that way, I think the answer is no." And then I met Bill Sloman from FIDS. And it just tickled my fancy. It was something I'd been looking for. I wanted a challenge. I had no real idea what I was going to do. I hadn't been trained as a surveyor, and that only happened after I was employed by FIDS. And we had Steve from Imperial College London who used to do this.
His name is?
Stevenson. Everybody calls him Steve. He's no longer, he was I don't know what rank he was at Imperial College, but he was a member of the British Graham Land expedition back in the 1930s, and he'd been heavily involved in Antarctic activities all along, and he had a lot of us that went through, the surveyors went through Steve. And we worked out of DOS, Department of Overseas Surveys, as it was then, and it changed. I think before that it was Colonial Surveys or something. But these were people who were really experienced in map-making, knew what they were doing, and so that's where we started. I had no idea, really, what we were going to do. I knew that the basis of surveying, but I didn't know anything about what sort of support you would get. I had not thought through the whole business of communication. I was just talking about with somebody about the whole business of Morse code. We all learned to send in Morse. I can't receive very well in Morse. And that's a technology that has simply gone. Mm. You know, it just has disappeared. We all learned, but we learned down there. So we had no idea, I think, when we went.
Why did you want to go down there? What was the attraction of the Antarctic?
I think it's because nobody had... In my naive way, I thought it was the last place on the planet that humans had trodden, really, basically. And that was, of course, I guess, biased by my view of Western Europe. I mean, we also thought, of course, the jungles of Brazil hadn't been trodden by humans. But, of course, that's very, very naive. But Antarctica was the place that nobody had been. And the mountains hadn't been climbed and all of that. This was it. And I was already a skier. And so it was attractive, and I thought it would be very beautiful. My family were dead against it.
What did Mother say?
Now, you have to understand the Welsh country people come from, although it's a beautiful area, inland Wales there, it's rather like the Irish. It's a country used to be of tenant farmers. My grandfather, my mother's father, had grown up almost starving, and he was a farm labourer and had struggled to pay or get food on the table. He worked for a tenant farmer as a farm labourer. My other grandfather was also not quite as poor as that, but he was also in that. And this is how they all clubbed together in London. It was easy. I'm told that the meetings of the milk folk in London were conducted in Welsh, not in English. The idea of Antarctica for her, she said, look, you've got all this education behind you. We expect you to make money. You see, that's the Cardi mindset. There are a lot of Cardi jokes in Welsh about how careful we are with money. I understand those jokes, and I understand the motivation behind those jokes, and I think there's something in it, and I think I am a real Cardi. We are careful. You won't find too many Cardis these days with my sort of background who are poor, I think. And I think that's to do with that. And so going to the Antarctica was essentially a denial of all the things that I had. And I go off to the end of the earth, in my mother's view, a dangerous place, because she had no experience of it. Mm. But my parents had no experience of university or any of these things, so...
Had you been aware of the heroic age of the Antarctic, Scott and Shackleton?
I had been aware of Scott. I had been slightly aware of Shackleton. I have never been a fan of Scott. I know that may be a rather nasty thing to say, but I think when I heard about horses being taken to snowy places and walking... That offended all of my mathematical training and physics training and everything I knew about horses. And so I couldn't understand how anybody could be that naive. And so Scott, I had a lot of problems with. And this was just a conceptual makeup of his expedition and man-hauling. So basic logistics, whereas Shackleton's ideas were much different. And I had fortune a few years ago with the Antarctic Club sit down to one of the last survivors of the Shackleton expedition. And he was one of the ones left under the longboats. And his
Can
name...
Can you call his name?
God, I have it. It escapes me at the moment, but I can certainly let you have that name.
Carry on.
And I said to this man, I said, did you truly expect Shackleton to come back? I mean, he sets off in the ship's longboat, you know, over 800 miles of some of the worst sea in the world. Oh, yeah, we knew he was going to come back. And that's a level of naivety that we have, maybe as Brits. I'm not sure that I was quite that naive. I did think there were dangers, but it was snowy waste and exciting and nobody'd done it before. And that, I think that was it. It's very, very simple.
You, like most of it, you travelled south via Port Stanley, and this would be in 1961?
61, yeah.
What was Stanley like in those days?
It was interesting to me. I had, although my background's Welsh, I had met all sorts of people here in Britain through the various things I had done, and I'd been very friendly with a young lady from what you might call upper-class England. And so I had seen how they had lived, and it had been at times a source of great mirth for me to meet some of those folk. And I get to Port Stanley and I see this little village, really. I mean, that's all it was. It's one street, no junctions, just went along the shore. And you had the one person, I think he had a Rolls Royce that was a doctor. And there was the governor, whom I knew his daughter.
Arrowsmith, was it?
Arrowsmith, yes. I can't remember the daughter's name now. And then they had these dances, and there was this upper class in the dances who sat together, and these were the local, basically, I think they were skilled trades-type people or shopkeepers. And then there were the others, and there was clearly this class distinction that I thought was rather curious, you know, that you go to this place, you have this little village, and that all of a sudden it sort of develops this sort of structure. I don't think that, for me, one of the big advantages of being Welsh, I think, is that we don't have that. It's an English thing. And I grew up in a community where we had surgeons in our chapel in London. We had people who were hourly paid and we were all together. We didn't have this. Now, education's a big difference with us, but it's not a question of class in that sense. You know, we don't have this upper and lower class, and we don't have an aristocracy.
Did you find it offensive or repulsive or disturbing?
No, I find it...
I meant in Stanley.
In Stanley. I thought it was peculiar, and I just wondered how it had happened, and I think it's just sort of like something you might write a novel about and create, like William Golding, you know, mm-hmm. that sort of thing, The Lord of the Flies, how you create, how humans create these sort of structures. I don't find it even offensive in Britain. If people don't mind it, that's fine. I don't bow to royalty. I don't bow to anybody. I mean, I wouldn't bow to the President of the United States. And God, the guy's been to the same universities I've been to. You know, what's it matter? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Did you have a sense, though, that it's almost like travelling back in time to go to Port Stanley at that time, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
A couple of decades earlier.
It was.
Did you look at this and think to yourself, I wonder how long this will last? It was inevitable that it would change.
For various reasons, yes. I went out into the sheep stations, actually. We had a visiting vet at the time. His name was Mike Godsall. They hadn't seen a vet in decades there. And Mike and I used to play bridge together on the ship. And so I went with him out to sheep station, and he pointed to a sheep, to one of these people run the sheep station. He said, "You've got some, they've got some, I think it was liver fluke or something." And the guy said, "Oh, no," he said. And he just told one of his men to catch a sheep, and they killed it right in front of us. And sure enough, they had it. I mean, Mike knew what he was doing. And there was a whole issue. They had been through the economy there, and the way they, the labor that fueled the island got there, how they were indentured was a curious period of history. And so in one sense, they had tried selling meat, for instance, from there. They'd even built a factory to do it, freeze it and sell it, without success, which meant that basically the business was for wool. And there was no prospect of it being anything else. The place is a totally barren place except for sheep. Sheep can live there. But you look at the sheep count and you look at the number of sheep per acre, you don't see many sheep. I've been across some of the places that they fought this war over were very sad. To me, you fight a war over something that's basically pretty barren. It's kind of reminded me of some of the moorlands we have in Wales or in Scotland. And there are no trees.
Let's take you further south, because your first season was at Stonington.
Yes.
And you were doing survey work out of Stonington. So I guess this is the old-fashioned dogs and sledging work, is it?
Yes, it was. Very much, I guess, we lived the way that you see in the movies, that we would have dogs, we would put food on the thing. My first experience down there was with the ships, though. We did a hydrographic survey on the way down. And that was an eye-opener, because we lost a helicopter.
Did we?
Right? Yes. Well, I, not personally. It wasn't mine. Yes, we had two on board HMS Protector, and I was working with the other one, but this one, I would guess it's still there, actually. Fortunately, nobody was killed.
What happened, either?
But we were providing control for oceanographic work, and the ships would drive up and down and take soundings, the sonic. And then out of this would become the marine maps, which I am sure are still being used. And I would doubt anybody's going to go back and change them, because that doesn't happen. It costs money. And nobody's run aground, because I look at the newspapers still. But nobody's run aground where we've been anyway. And so, yeah, getting to base, there were dogs. I liked dogs a lot. And I was disappointed, of course, when I got there, because I couldn't get a dog team, because I was surveyor, you see. Dog teams are given to other people. But in my second year, I inherited a team from Johnny Cunningham called the Admirals, which is actually one of the oldest teams. I think it was one of the last teams to exist down there, actually, the Admirals and the Huns. And I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Adelaide, this would be?
It took it to Adelaide. They had been at Stonington, though, before. And yes.
What was special about working with dogs, having your own team?
Well, I think it's not just, I've worked also with machines. We had these earlier skidoo type things. When you get back after a hard day's work, the thing sits there. There's no greeting. I got back after surveying with dogs, and all the dogs get up and they greet you. It is just, you need something. I think humans need affection, and dogs give it in abundance. And when I think of the animals that I had, how remarkable creatures, and the places that I went with them, they saved my life so many times. That I had so much to be grateful for using them, that we went to places that tractors could never go. Going up and down glaciers, I would never take a tractor. You'd lose it. So I think it's something that the human psyche needs. They need And as if I rank the things I missed down there, I missed women. At that time, that we didn't have women as a company, female company. But without dogs there, that would have been absolutely, for me, awful. It was just to be there in an environment isolated from half of humanity, with only machines, would have been that would have been a huge penalty.
You also said you missed insects.
Yes, I did.
Can you elaborate on that?
It's a funny thing. You know, you spend hours out and you can't see a fly, you can't see a bee, and you do this for more than 2 years of your life, and you start wondering about it. There are no mosquitoes, there's no nothing. Not spiders, nothing. Nothing that essentially is living. Now, it's not totally true, because there are some lichens down there, but there are no plants either. And so you do miss it. I suppose plants also to some extent, but more the insects. It's life, and it is dead. This is pristine place. Was. And we got more and more pollution down there, and this is sad. But it was pristine and dead.
Were you ever bowled over by the beauty of it all?
By?
The beauty of it all.
Oh, absolutely. It's stunningly beautiful. Stunningly beautiful. Like, just about everywhere. I mean, I know that all the tourists go down, they go through the Mare Channel, and they're bowled over because the mountains are beautiful. And I think when people think of Antarctica, they still think of the Scot pulling his man hauling across the plateau. There is a plateau which is fairly flat, all of that. But the striking thing, I think, are the mountains and the sheer beauty of the colours that you get from the sun and the clarity. I was able to, with my, I'm sure, ex-World War II theodolite telescope, which was not good, I was able to pick out man-sized objects easily at 40 miles. I mean, that is amazing, because the air is totally clean and it is so pristine. You could see the mountains. It's only the curvature of the earth that stops you from seeing anything. It is so crystal clear. And you can never... And that shows itself at night time, which, unless you've wintered there, you've never really experienced. But wintering there and having that whole sky with that clarity of air is just an extraordinary experience.
You describe sitting on the top of Petermann Island.
Yes.
Can you remember that moment?
Yes, I can. I had, of course, you know about seal and you know about whales and stuff like that, but when you look out on the bay and you see dozens of the biggest whales that there are on the planet... marching up and down and blowing, I could hear them. And then another patch, God knows how many seal, the water was alive with them. The bay must have been stuffed full of krill, and they were there feeding. But it was just extraordinary. It was just a totally silent day, no clouds in the sky. And I was sitting there, I can't remember what instrument I had, probably... We worked then with these microwave instruments called telurometers and theodolites, of course. And I can't remember who was with me just like that, but we just sat on the top of Petermann Island, and it was extraordinary, just listening to this mass of animal life down in the water. Just extraordinary.
How much surveying work could you get done? Was it intensive?
In summer, we were basically working the islands, and first of all, it started up in the north, the South Shetlands, and then we moved down, let's say, Petermann Island. Then, and it was always using the helicopters from Protector. Yes, we were out in the field. I haven't counted up the months a year, but probably more than half the year I was out in the field. I don't think people do that anymore. It really is if it's people say, well, how did you shower? What a question. How did shower? How about wash? You don't wash, you don't shower. And of course, you get pretty steamy and your beard grows. And that can get pretty disgusting at times because it's cold and your beard freezes, all of that. And, you know, the joke is that you've got somewhere there is, you know, the meal that you had 2 weeks ago. But yeah, it's different. And you live on an airbed, which has got a sheepskin on it and a double sleeping bag. And we go out into the minus, God knows what, minus 40s, whatever. And you know how to do it.
Did you feel a connection with the heroic age? Did you feel as though you were experiencing the kind of things that Scott and Shackleton were experiencing?
Do you know, I don't think I thought about it that much. I'm sure that we lived pretty much the same way that they did because we used primer stoves. And you put in methylated spirits, and you had to heat the meth when it was cold. I mean, everybody gets used to the idea of methylated spirits is very very flammable and is going to become gas. Well, we had to heat it in order to get the meth going, and then you have the meth gets the paraffin going. It's Americans would probably use what they call white gas, and they don't use a starter. That's much more explosive. But we were using old-fashioned primer stoves, and that's how we dried our gear. If you run with dogs, it's a very different thing. You see all these pictures now of all these people wearing these down jackets. You can't do that. A down jacket doesn't work. You just fill up with ice because you sweat, and that goes into the down jacket, and it freezes because it's cold. And even if you have an anorak on, you actually line the inside of the anorak. It lines with ice. And so in the evening, you have to hang it up in your tent, inside out. Doesn't matter much because there's no moisture in the air. And it dries out. It dries out from the fumes from your little primer stove.
Is that efficient? It dries out quickly, does it?
Yes, it does, because there's no moisture in the air, you see. Because the temperature's so low, the relative humidity is like zip. And so,
you were in tents that weren't that dissimilar from
very
Amundsen
similar.
And Scott.
Actually, the tents we use. I was up in Cambridge. Was it 3 years ago? Looking at the gear they use now, the tents are virtually the same. They look like tetrahedra, and they have a pole in each corner, and the triangle, as I know from my undergraduate studies, triangle is a very powerful shape. And a tetrahedron is about as strong a shape as you could have. So there are huge advantages to that shape to withstand winds. And Antarctic winds, what we call katabatic winds that come off the plateau, can be over 200 miles an hour. I don't know what the fastest are because nobody's ever measured these things, but they are very fast. You need a tent that can withstand that. And there have been occasions, I know, when these tents have not withstood it, but they are very rare. So this is a better design we have yet to find. And round ones wouldn't do it quite as well, I think. So
there's some lovely anecdotes in your notes. I'd like to guide you through them, if I may. That you were talking about one evening being on at anchor on HMS Protector.
Oh, yeah.
and an iceberg home interview. And the captain seemed to have a rather unusual technique for dealing with the situation.
Well, it wasn't the captain. I think it's the officer of the watch. The officer of the watch. You have to understand that I'm ex-Air Force. And so I know they always call the Air Force the junior service. I mean, quite honestly, I'm glad I was not in the Navy. But, yeah, the officer of the watch summoned about, I don't know, 12... able-bodied seamen grasping this large wooden pole, trying to push off this iceberg, which was above us. I mean, if you have an iceberg that big, you know it's much bigger than the ship. If you know anything about physics, you know, and approximately 90% is underwater. So what you've got is a little tip. And you can guarantee it's all solid. And if you're not familiar with icebergs, I can assure you it's like hitting granite if you hit them like that. And there they were, and of course, I was asking a simple question. I said, are you pushing the ship away from the berg or the berg away from the ship? And he thought we were, I was there with a friend, he thought we were just taking the mickey out of him. And we were both indeed laughing. It was a futile effort. I mean, this is pushing, you can imagine, it's just the friction of their shoes on the deck, trying to push away this humongous thing. The ship was, the protector was, you know, over 1,000 tons, I'm sure, whatever. It's just a totally useless... They should move the ship. That's the sensible thing. Say, hey, look, berg, move the ship. Pull up the anchor and just move. That did not seem to cross their minds.
Was there a collision?
It just slid past. All that can happen. But that's the best thing. The worst thing is that was one of the oldest ships commissioned in the British Navy. So, as I understand it, it was from World War One and been modified.
So did it feel like an antiquity on board?
Yes, it did, because you'd sling up a hammock. People, you walk down the gangways and there'd be hammocks hanging and people be in those things. I was very fortunate when I was on board because I was in the wardroom, so I was one with the officers. But it is a very different culture to the Air Force. I think the Royal Air Force is different because the people that fix aircraft and the pilots that fly them don't have a class distinction in there. They know each other by their names. They know the guys flying the planes know that the guys fixing the planes, they got to do it right. Otherwise, you know, they're dead. And the Navy, they still quote Nelson, for heaven's sake. And they fly a helicopter and every time they want to send something, they're looking in a book for some Nelson quote. Yeah, I thought it was bizarre. And anyway, all part of my education.
Your first summer, you did some work in the South Shetland Islands, and at that point, talking about the difference between the Army and the Navy, there was a helicopter which went missing.
Yes.
What's that story, Ivor?
Well, this I followed up some years later because I realised that one of the reasons that the Navy did this down there was to train their people in extreme conditions, and we had Marines on board who would go off for training trips and so on. And I guess it's unfortunate that the Navy hadn't had any specialised training in flying helicopters in these conditions. And so that apparently, I had related this when I was later in Canada. I had met some executives from Okanagan Helicopter. Now, these guys work in the Rockies and they work in cold conditions and so on. And they train pilots to work in these conditions. And I related to him this, the crash, and this one with Alan Wright, where Alan was being winched down on an island and what happened to Alan, where the helicopter loses its ground effect. And they told me that, quite simple, he said, this is a pilot error, but it's lack of training. And he said that you can't blame the pilot, they just don't know how to do it, but he said this is just a lack of training. Of course, you understand that this can happen if you've not encountered these conditions, which the Navy presumably hadn't. But there were people around in Canada, obviously, who did know how to fly in those conditions.
So what were the two incidents?
Well, the one was the crash, which, as I understand it, and I was not involved in it, the FIDs were in it, they were inside it, and this thing landed on the top, it's not down at sea level, it was quite high, and it crashed, apparently, because it lost its ground effect. There's a cushion effect as you get close to the ground. Bounced up and started rolling and unfortunately stopped, I believe, on the edge of a cliff somewhere. And nobody was hurt, amazingly, although the pilot was in the state of shock, obviously. But the FIDs, of course, inside, FIDs are very durable sort of creatures, being tossed around like, you know, they just got out shaking their heads. So it wasn't that. So we were down to one helicopter that finished our survey. You can't fly down there with just one helicopter. That's no good. The second one was Alan. That was somewhere off Adelaide, and he was being winched down. And the same sort of thing happened, except that he had been winched onto the island, and at that point, the helicopter lost its ground effect. Now, he's there. I mean, this is like a comedy thing, except the helicopter's now plummeting down, and as I understand it, almost crushed him, at which point, as you can guess, it took off again and shot into the air. Of course, Alan is still tied on to this helicopter. So at this point, presumably, he shoots up in the air. I did not see this, but it's that sort of thing. And we landed on all sorts of weird islands, of course. One of the things that they did learn, which is to use dye. We get whiteout conditions. You can't see this where the surface is. You don't know whether it's 20 feet below you or 200 feet. So you drop dye out, and this would mark the snow, and you could see exactly where the surface is. So the pilot could see where it was. That was okay.
There was one incident where you yourself were involved on Adelaide Island when you lost your gear due to a helicopter malfunction.
Well, that's because they took... I said that I was going to be carried by helicopter to the north part of Adelaide Island, and my whole sled was ready, and we were going to use the skidoo for this thing, not dogs. And I said to them, well, is it okay? I mean, how are we going to take it out? They said, oh, we've got this belly hook under the helicopter. I said, is that safe? They said, oh, yeah, it's safe. And, of course, they take off. There's my whole thing hanging under it, all my gear. And they get halfway across the bay, and the hook releases, and everything plummets and is smashed in the water. So I lost the whole thing. I have no idea why that happened. I suspect they don't either. But of course, my theodolite was there, so I had to take the theodolite that one of the naval officers had that we'd been working with. We'd been working with Barry, I can't remember his name, a surname, but I took his theodolite instead, which actually wasn't as nice as mine, but hey, but I could live with it.
It sounds like it's a miracle that any survey ever got done with all these incidents coming on.
Well, I think in retrospect, it is amazing what the Brits have done in Antarctica for the amount of money that has been spent. I think the way we lived, I don't know how many people would do what we did for as little money. We certainly didn't go for money. And live the life that we lived. I just wonder how many people would do that. I think you've got to be into... You've got to enjoy the adrenaline kick, and I guess be looking for something different. It's certainly not. It's not an. I mean, even I and I'm. You know, I expect everybody to do everything, but there are things that happen down there that I would never do. I mean, the young woman who was killed in. I think in 2005, and she was snorkeling, and she was caught by a leopard seal. And
Kirsty Brown.
Yes. I would never, I mean, crazy as I am, and I've been helicopter skiing in Austria, I've done all these things. I would never go snorkeling in the Antarctic. I think you're going to be crazy. I mean, I did crazy things, and I'm fortunate to have lived through them, but snorkeling... Man, you got that. I took my hat up when I heard about it. My friend Dave Nash, who is not here, David's daughter was the doctor on the base. So Dave's daughter went down, and I heard about it soon afterwards. It was tragic. But there are things that I think that what we did was pretty extreme.
Well, did you have some scary moments?
Lots. These can be divided, I think I was just talking to somebody, into two categories. One, what I call jollies. doing things that the survey didn't ask us to do. And there are lots of those. With Ian McMorran, I was up on Nenny Island. We were looking to see the sun. We hadn't seen the sun for a few months. So we climbed up and it had an avalanche right below my feet, literally below my feet. And there was a crack between Ian and me. That's one. Another one, I was climbing another mountain with Ian, Roman IV. We had climbed it. And I think when you're in your 20s, you think you're immortal, invincible. We had baggy pants, because that's what Fids gave us, or Bass, I guess I was then. I caught my crampons in my pants, and I literally took off and I somersaulted. This is a very steep snow gully. And fortunately, at that moment, my brain seems to speed up or something. I was able to. It seemed like I had all the time in the world to get hold of my ice axe and put it under me as in the textbook fashion. And as I hit the snow, I rammed it in and I stopped. And that was a close one. So those were I call jollies. And then there are some things that are sort of in between. And that was again with Ian. Ian and I were out in a Norwegian pram dinghy. I don't know if you know what a pram dinghy is. It's a clinker-built little thing. It's not very long. Had a little outboard on it. And we were looking for seal. And this giant whale popped up right alongside the pram dinghy. I'm a creature the size of which I had never seen in my life. I think it was probably just curious. But it's a hell of a feeling when you think this is like a mountain that comes up beside you and keeps coming. This is a blue whale, of course, and it's kind of scary.
A Moby Dick moment?
Certainly Moby Dick. I didn't communicate with this creature. Maybe it was trying to communicate with us. It certainly did in some way. And then other moments, which I would cast as just part of the job. We did a probably a fairly epic journey, I think, from Adelaide across to Stonington, all the way to King George VI Sound. At the entrance to the sound was a lot of what we call pressure ice. And this pressure ice can be quite tall, I mean 20, 30 feet tall. We're trying to find a way through. And so the gang of us, there were six of us on this journey, we were walking through and I was leading. And I had, in those days, skis, but they were loose bindings. And suddenly the ground fell and I fell about 10 feet, I would think, maybe a little bit more. I don't know. I remember looking up at this wall of blue ice and here am I swimming in the slush in the sea, a crevasse in the pressure ice. Fortunately, one of the gang had a rope, had the presence of mind to take a rope with us, and so I was hauled out in short order. That is really, in retrospect, without that rope, they would have had to have tied anoraks together. By yourself, you'd be dead. You can't get out. Blue ice is like granite. That's one. Another one in the sound
was... That was Jim Shercliffe who had the rope, wasn't
it? Was Jim Shercliffe. Jim Shercliffe had the rope.
How did you recover from that? Because you would have been completely wet and exhausted.
Oh, yeah. You don't stay wet very long. It just freezes. You crackle. You crackle. You walk like something out of a movie, like a toy soldier. You crackle, and actually once it warms up, as I remember, I don't remember being terribly cold once I got out. I had to get back to the tent and dry off everything. But the thing, you freeze so quickly that once you're out, it's okay, because you got your gear on and you warm up inside it. It's not like you're wet. That doesn't last long down there. Coming down from the sound, I remember, at the end of our survey season, this is from the actual Antarctic plateau, and we were using this glacier that we had used to go up. It had been like going up the M6, you know. It was fantastic, beautiful, like a highway. The sun had been working on it. There's a lot of sun down there in summer. And the bridges were falling on the crevasses, and that is scary. When you have crevasses that are 3-4 feet wide, you've got to take them absolutely right angles. And even then, you know, you're worried about your dogs going in. I mean, this is really, if you want an adrenaline kick, this was more than I really had ever hoped for. How I got down, let alone Dave, I never heard his story. But I couldn't stop. That was the terrible thing. You have a brake on these sleds. I couldn't stop, and I was worried about stopping anyway because my dogs wouldn't have known what was happening, and they would fall in. And so you get down the bottom, and I tell you, this was one of those moments. You just know that somebody was looking after you. But it's just amazing that you survive. And so some of these events that you have, like that, where there's nobody to blame. I mean, you know, when you're in a plane, you get lost, and that happened. But those things, you know, are different. This one, all my fault, really. I mean, why did I take this route? I didn't know a better one. And I had to get down. And somebody saved us, and it was just one of those days.
Your reference to an almighty being is interesting there. Did you?
Well, we used to say there's some mythical goddess who was looking after us, actually. It wasn't
you said that,
the
you
almighty.
Said that among yourselves, did you?
Yes. I've forgotten her name now, but it was there was some this mythical creature that was looking after all the FIDs, because there were so many of these incidents. And we had them with aircraft. I mean, I can think of several.
You were flying with Bob Bond to Stonington one day. Tell me about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is what happens. There are no navigation aids. You do have a compass down there, but the compass is unreliable down there because the geographic pole, South Pole, ain't where you think it is. Most people don't realize that it's actually offshore. Down there, it's not on the continent. So that's a problem. And then going to Adelaide from Sydney, it's not very far. I think it's only about 70 miles or something if you're a crow. Difficult journey if you're not a crow, unless there's really good sea ice, which doesn't happen that often. And we took off a normal journey. And I was in the co-pilot seat, and the clouds came in. I couldn't see anything. And, of course, Bob couldn't see anything either. I don't know if he remembers this even. He's probably had so many of these incidents. And he turns to me and he says, "Where do you think we are?" And I thought, that's not a question I want to hear from him. He's a pilot. He's supposed to know. And at that moment, I could, a break in the cloud, I could see a peak. There are mountains there, you see, you can hit. You know, this is not without risk. And I saw this peak up to the left, and I made a guess. It turned out that was wrong. And we just kept going because he's a pretty cool head. I have a great deal of respect for Royal Air Force pilots. And eventually we broke out of the cloud, and of course we had gone way too far south, and we just turned around back under the cloud into Stonington. But, you know, no navigation aids, you're guessing all the time, there's a lot of risk associated with the way we used to do it. And of course they've got GPS these days, which will help a lot. You wonder what's going to happen if suddenly the satellites up there get blown up, because we fly all the time now with GPS. And if we lose those satellites, it's going to be total chaos on this planet. But that's where we are. And I didn't have that many scary moments in the aircraft, and we got used to taking off on glaciers and landing on glaciers. That was totally normal, or landing on the Sound, which is flat. This was just normal. These are not made runways. You're landing on the skis all the time. And so that ceases to be exciting. It's just some of these other little things.
You had to come, or you were called to the rescue of George MacLeod, who'd fallen down the crevasse.
Yeah.
This was on the on King George VI Sound, I believe.
Yes.
What was your first knowledge of the problem?
Well, the thing is that we were on the east side of the Sound, up on the plateau. They were on the west side of the Sound, and up from the Sound in a very, very difficult area, full of crevasses, it turned out. And the first thing we heard was on the radio that George had fallen down this hole. Fortunately, he's a very tough guy. Miraculously, I would say, having seen the hole, he's a mountaineer. He'd been able to climb out. And that is incredible, without falling back, because he had broken God knows how many ribs, and heaven knows, you know, he was in bad shape. So we went across to rescue them. That meant going down from where we were, crossing the Sound, going up the other side. And we found them.
We were racing against time.
Yes, we were in very difficult... They were in terrible place. It was just awful, crevasses. But, you know, all's well that ends well. He's still alive, as far as I know, and still, I think he's now back in Scotland. But he's a tough guy.
What could he do when he got there?
Well, what we could do was give Ralph Horn. You have to realize the guy is basically an invalid, and you have he's got a dog team, which was not Ralph's business either. He's a geologist, and so somebody had to sort of give him some assistance, and we had the people to do that, so we could give him physical help with dogs and the whole thing. So it just is so much easier. I mean, George really was. He was badly injured. If he'd been in this country, he would have been in the hospital, obviously, but... he just bruised and broken ribs, and I don't know what else was wrong, but the hole he went into was impressive. I have a picture of it.
So what was he taken? Was he evacuated from the Antarctic?
No, he just recovered
on base.
Yeah, we were in the Sound. You know, there were no aircraft with us at that time. That's the way things were. The aircraft came down later because we had done the journey over sea ice from Margaret Bay. These are journeys that I don't think people will ever do again. Hmm. Will ever do again. So that was truly an epic journey. I was always nervous about camping on sea ice. I talked to Bunny Fox some after returning. He had worked in that area. And it was clear... from what he said, that when he had been down there, that the ice was much better, the sea ice. He didn't have to deal with the variation and the uncertainties that we had to deal with. And I guess it was just part of that trend that we now call global warming, which obviously didn't just start 10 years ago, you know, it's been going for a while. And that's why we had to leave the base on Adelaide Island. And I've seen pictures, which are astounding to me. But, you know, there are a lot of people who still don't believe it's happening.
Were there moments of humour as well, amongst all these near misses?
Lots of humour. I thought the one on Protector was funny.
What's the story there?
Well, that was pushing off the iceberg. I thought, yeah. And of course it was... potentially tragic, but potentially tragic. Falling in tide crack is kind of humorous. It's happened to me. A tide crack is a thing, if you're not familiar with it, is, as the, of course, all sea rises and falls with tides, and then where the ice meets the shore, there is a crack as this thing goes up and down. And I just had a colleague who was working up in Alaska, and he heard that I'd been to Antarctica, and that we talked and about things. And of course, I forgot to tell him about tide cracks. And he nearly fell in Alaska. And that was of quite large dimensions, the one he fell in, or nearly fell in. But the one I thought, it happened every so often, because you thought you were on pretty sound ice, and boom, you just go through, and you, very embarrassing, you just get out, you're like stiff with water again. Yeah, there are those moments. I don't think that Antarctica, I don't think of that as the humorous part of my life so much. So.
Well, there's a very good story about the baked bean tin.
Oh, the baked beans. Oh, yeah. Well, that one of our chores was to be cook. And we worked with a stove that I think people would probably relate to an Arga. And these are stoves that are running all the time. We don't have those sort of things now where I live, because summer's too hot. But we had this stove always going, and I think it was Ron Gill, our diesel mechanic, who had left some cans of baked beans on the stove to defrost, because everything we brought in the house was frozen. And he left them there too long, and these things had exploded. And exploding baked beans travel in straight lines, it turns out. And the flex on the light, I remember everything that was in the way of the baked beans left a precise shadow on the ceiling or wherever. I mean, it was absolutely perfect. And it was, so if, even if there was a hole in the flex, it would have done the whole thing. The chain would be up there. I thought it was remarkable. Of course, we did have tomato ketchup all over the ceiling. Yeah, that was certainly amusing, but everything has its downside. You have to clean that stuff off.
Were there any instances where you were being innovative in the Antarctic? You were solving problems, introducing new ideas, new technology?
Well, I tried to introduce the idea of using our handheld cameras for survey work so that we do a panoramic view with... so I created a thing out of brass. Brass, it must have been. That we had some brass there, really, so that you could put the camera on it and just go angle, say 30 degrees and move another 30 degrees or whatever. And indeed, we used those photographs, and they were sent back to DOSC. So you look at some of the readings, you don't know what's down there, but when you have a whole panoramic photograph, it really gives you a much better idea of where you are and what sort of country you're dealing with and whether the points you're looking at make any sense and so on. I found them very, very useful myself.
Was that adopted by other surveyors after you?
I don't know. To really make that work, you would have had to have had a little bit more precision than mine had when you set up the camera. But yes, it was used back in DOS, I know, by Bob Metcalf. Those photographs that I took were used by him.
Hmm. So, and you and Dave Nash also did some work on the Port Stanley radio station.
Yeah, well, the thing about radio stations is that they have a big antenna, and you have to orient this thing to maximize the signal strength. And they wanted to know what was the best place you had to know where the signal was coming from. You had to orient this antenna from the station there. And so we did. Yeah, we provided them with sort of where they should put this antenna. And I've forgotten the details of that thing. But yeah, we did. Port Stanley was full of all sorts of surprises. That was something I never thought I would ever do. I actually, one time on Port Stanley, that was funny, my vet friend, Godsell, Mike, there was a house that had a huge number of cats, and the cats kept on breeding and having kittens. So the chore was to go and spay all these cats. And one day I went as Mike's assistant to catch these cats in this house. I don't know if you've ever tried to catch cats. They don't come willingly to have their insides cut open and their bits tied. And there we were. And we had had a party the night before. And God, it was the funniest thing, chasing these bloody cats around with towels, throwing a towel on a cat, trying to roll it in the towel. This is how you do it. But then you have to unroll it sufficiently for Mike to actually do the surgical stuff. And so that, I forget how many cats they had, but it was like a dozen of them. It was not like two or three. And so this was a bizarre interlude. I think the whole entry of a veterinary surgeon type to the Falklands must have been quite novel. I think they hadn't had one in decades. I mean, maybe half a century.
Key change. Can you put your finger on any other key change which you think has changed the way that FIDs are today compared to your day?
I would think that it has to have changed. We were very small in number. You know, bases were, with us, maybe 10 or 12 people. Absolutely no privacy for anybody. No women. Well, I mentioned that before. But it's not that. It's just that there is also, when you go out in the field, there's no support. You know that if you get into trouble, there's nobody can come and help. I think that aspect has changed in a big way. And I think people more and more who work down there are there for a very short period. They go in the summer and they come out.
You think the lack of wintering has changed things a lot, do you?
Yes, I do. And I think it changes the social adhesion of a group. Some of my closest friends still remain from those days. Ian McMoran, I mentioned. Rourke Bryan, who was a Met man at Adelaide. Rourke was a professor of geography at the University of Toronto, so he's another North American like me. But these people I've known now all those years and will continue to know till the day I die. And the number of the people here at this reunion I've known for not quite as closely as I do. Ian and I, he is one of my closest friends.
So you've flown from Massachusetts?
I flew on Wednesday.
For this?
For this. This ties in. My wife and I bought a little cottage in Breton about 3 years ago. So I have a tenant change right now in Oxfordshire. In the Cotswolds.
You've had a very long and illustrious career after your FIDS days. A lot of time in North America, India, Germany, China. Yeah. How does the Antarctic rate in the lifespan of Ivan Morgan?
You know, I was sitting down with a good friend of mine in Boston. He's Australian. And we were talking about what motivates us. And he's clearly motivated. I've known him for 30 years. He has set his sight on making money. And John is rolling in money. He's had a heart bypass operation. He owns high rises in Boston and God knows what. You know, he runs his own firm. He's a marketing guy. He's got his own firm that's specialist and stuff. And we sat down. He said, well, what drives me? And that was an interesting question. And I think I look for challenges. I never thought I would get a doctoral degree from Harvard University, and people listen to me, and I'm such a Brit. And I was just talking to somebody here. She says, you're an American professor. And I said, nobody's called me that before. It's like an insult. And then they say, I say, well, I've got a doctorate from an American university. An American university? Oh, my God. Even if it's Harvard, you know, for some reason, people think it's sort of something less than you would have here. And of course, in my field, that's absurd, truly absurd. So I think that was a challenge. It was extremely risky. I had a young child at the time, and I had very little money. Money has never been a motivator for me. But I've still got that Welsh country thing, you see. And so it's not that we live that badly. It's just that I'm not like my Australian friend. I do not have high rises. But I do have a house in New Hampshire on the lake and all that stuff. So we're not, these days, that's not the problem.
But you also have 2 years in the Antarctic in your memory, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I have memories of China, which are still very vivid to me. I did a fair amount in Shanghai and living in Switzerland, living in Spain. My Spanish connection now goes back 20 years.
Well, I was wondering where on that list of locations the Antarctic lies for you.
Oh, I think it's still right at the top. It's still the one that's giving me the biggest challenge, the biggest adrenaline kick. But even going to Switzerland gave me a big kick because I didn't really know how that was going to pan out. This is a very well-known institution. And then going to Spain, you have a different challenge. It's the language. I mean, my French wasn't that bad. I do speak German because my wife is German. But that's taken me 40 years, for heaven's sake. And then I dump into Spain, and my Spanish was saying nothing. A lot of my contemporaries at university went to Spain in the summer. I never did. I went to France. So all of a sudden, there I am in Spain and in Catalonia, where they speak Catalan as well. So that was really a big challenge. It has been extraordinarily enriching experience for me, and I still work with those folk. Mm. After 20 years. Now, mind you, some of them now come to Boston. I do things in Boston for them. But it really has been super. But when I stack them all up as an experience, I still think this was the most extraordinary.
Marvellous, Ivor. Thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure. Absolute pleasure.